Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. On the Ides of March in the year 44 BC, Julius Caesar was stabbed to death in the Roman Senate by a group of assassins led by his friend Brutus. Brutus and his fellow conspirators said that Caesar was a tyrant, and that they murdered Caesar to preserve liberty and the Roman Republic. Most historians have accepted their claim. However, my guest today presents a startling new view of Caesar's murder and its meaning for our own republic. He is noted political analyst Dr. Michael Parenti, author of The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. So please join us for this edition of History Counts, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, after this short break. Welcome back to History Counts. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. Today we're going to re-examine the life and times of one of the most famous people in history, Julius Caesar. To help us, we're very fortunate to have as our guest Dr. Michael Parenti, author of The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. Dr. Parenti received a PhD from Yale University in political science. He's written 20 books and 275 articles. He lectures to academic and other groups throughout the country. His most recent book, Contrary Notions, The Michael Parenti Reader, was published in 2007 by City Lights Book. His book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, was chosen Book of the Year for Nonfiction in 2004 by Online Review of Books. Thanks very much for being with us, Dr. Parenti.
Nice to be here, Ken.
Not everybody's too familiar with Roman history, so could we start by talking about putting Julius Caesar in context? What stage was Rome in its development when he flourished?
Well, the book is really about Caesar, but it's really more about Rome and the society and the big issues, which I think is still relevant today. We think of Rome as the arena and the emperors strutting around and all that, but for about 500 years, Rome was a republic of some sort. That is, the people fought over the century to get some kind of popular representation, some kind of voice in what was happening. It was a very imperfect republic with all sorts of elite vetoes and, dead ends and blockages. And the founding fathers, the U.S., actually looked to Rome as the kind of model they want. That is, there'd be a popular assembly. People might have some input, but there would be a Senate. There would be these consuls. Well, in our system, we have a president, and they really exercised power. So it was a republic just barely. And if the people could really mobilize and really bring the votes in from the provinces and all that, they sometimes could pass a law that enabled them to get something of a better deal, like some land reform or something like that.
So we're talking about the first century before Christ.
Right.
And so Rome had conquered most of the Mediterranean, but it was still a republic.
Yes. In its own government, it was a republic, but it also was an empire. And, we've seen that with Great Britain, and we've seen that with the United States. You can have some semblance of a democracy at home, but you still have rulers who are pursuing their global interests.
Now, Caesar came from a very wealthy, a very ancient Roman family, but you say he was the greatest of the Popularis. Could you talk about the political parties that operated in the Republic, the Popularis and the Optimates?
Yeah, right, the Optimates, or Optimates, as we would say in English. The Optimates were the Senate, which was composed of originally about 300 members and then later expanded to 600. It was really monopolized by a coterie of super rich and reactionary senators, and they were called the Optimates, and sometimes they were called also the Pauci, I guess it would be pronounced in Latin, the few. They were the super elites who really ran the Senate. They spoke first, they had seniority, they manipulated all sorts of things. And the other faction, a smaller one, but still notable, was made up of people called the Populares. Some of them were senators, some of them were tribunes, others. Populares, it literally meant demagogue, somebody who played on the people or something.
It had a derogatory connotation.
It was actually not a flattering term then. It's not at all clear that the populares.
Who gave them the name populares?
Well, let me just say, it's not at all clear that they themselves ever used that name. As I point out, 100 years before Caesar, there was a string of populare leaders who were killed because they outspokenly supported, or they may not have been populares. In one or two cases, they were just reformers who had no popular following, but who thought, hey, it would be a lot better if we did this, or a lot more equitable if we did that.
The populares were responding, the leaders that you're referring to, were responding to what you described as the wide disparities of wealth in Rome.
Right.
Was it a greatly polarized society in terms of economics?
Yes, it was. A few thousand people really owned most of the wealth, by Caesar's day, had already taken over most of the choice land around Rome and the whole Campania region and all those areas. Very fertile land, which had once been worked by independent farmers who fed all of Rome,
This is a key development in the terms of the polarization of wealth was the subversion of the ager publica. Could you talk about what that land was?
Ager publica was the public land, the publicly owned land, which the rich latifundia owners, and latifundia was what they were called in Latin. It's come down to us through Spanish and Latin America. But they drove these people off the land, and they took their land and built them up into big plantations, latifundia, which were run by slave labor. And this is where war came in and empire came in very usefully, because the peasants were the infantry. They were really the muscle behind the Roman army. The army had a mediocre cavalry, okay archery, but it's the Roman army's real power, legendary, was its legionaries, its infantry. So these guys would go away for years and fight, and they came back, their farms were gone, couldn't keep them up, their families driven off and all.
You said the law provided that no individual could own more than 300 acres. So how did the wealthy manage to amass these large farms, plantations?
Right. There are laws in the U.S. that individuals can get subsidies, agricultural subsidies, only up to a certain size, and they're ignored the same way. these laws were pretty much just ignored or ridden over, or just torn up and...
So where did the small farmers, the members of these collectives, where did they end up? Did they go to the city? Did they become serfs? What happened to them?
Many of them stay in the army. If they're really poor, sometimes they end up in slavery. But a great number of them do end up in the city and become the Roman proletariat.
And these were the people that Caesar and the popularis who preceded him would be appealing to?
Yes. These were the people, and included small landholders too, and including some well-off people like Caesar who felt this has got to be, we've got to give a little to keep a lot, and it's got to be a more equitable situation than it is. It's getting pretty bad.
Well, among the leaders that preceded Caesar in representing the proletarians were the Gracchi brothers. Can you talk about them?
Yeah, the Gracchi were from very reputable families, and they became tribunes. Now, the tribunes, I mentioned the tribunate was probably the most democratic institution in the Roman Republic. It was made up, if you were aristocrat, you couldn't be a member of the tribune. And they had power to challenge the Senate, and they had power to push popular bills through. And it was 12 members. The only problem was they had to act with unanimity. So, of course, the aristocracy could always get one or two elected or sell out or buy them off, who could veto things. So it was not as great a thing, but it's started with Tiberius Gracchi, who really made popular appeals and brought home the need for more equitable reform, improvement. And it wasn't just land reform. It was improvement in wages, debt cancellation, rent subsidies, housing programs, work projects, so there'd be jobs for the...
So these guys were pretty sophisticated. They had a thorough populist agenda.
They did. Well, the Gracchi did. Tiberius Gracchus and his brother Gaius Gracchus did have very well-developed agendas. And, you know, we're talking, let's say, 70 years later, Caesar is pushing some of these very same programs.
What happened to Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus?
They were both assassinated by goon squads, hired thug of the optimates, the optimate.
They must have been very persuasive people. You have a quote from Tiberius Gracchus referring to the landless veterans. He said, "They fight and fall to serve no other end but to multiply the possessions of the rich."
Right. So there's a very real class awareness that the rich were really ripping everyone else off.
There was a technique that they used that you cite, and pardon me if I mispronounce this, Senatus Consultum Ultimum, which was
right.
Sort of like a super patriot act.
Ultimum. It was like a martial, it was a declaration of martial law.
And the Senate would invoke this?
Yeah, and they would invoke it every so often. In effect, saying all rights have been suspended, and we're going to round up who we want, and that's that. And by the way, when we say the Gracchi were murdered, also hundreds of their followers were killed. And these were massacres that went on.
How did they get away with it?
They got away with it because they got the wealth, and the wealth allows them to hire the armies, buy off the generals, mobilize, organize, you know, very much well coordinated with each other, whereas organizing a mass of people is not that easy. People who have to go earn a living and try to keep body and soul together and raise families and all that.
And they were notable amongst a long line of popularis leaders. The Gracchi. And you say, quote, "In sum, just about every leader in the middle and late republic who stood up for the popularis cause met a violent end."
That's right. Or who even just suggested some substantive reform. They may not have identified themselves as popularis. Yeah.
There's a technique that the optimatists use that sounded familiar. You say they equated the general good with their own special privileges, and they opposed popular reforms by attacking the reformers and their motives.
Right. Doesn't that sound familiar indeed? That's exactly it. Every popular reformer was demonized and smeared as self-promoting, megalomaniacal, a rabble-rouser, so forth, offending, and so forth.
So it was in this context that Julius Caesar starts his career, and he immediately, early on, he was a politician, associated himself with this popularis cause.
Right, but Caesar began to surmise one thing, that he was going to get nowhere, and he was probably not going to live very long unless he had an army at his back. And so he then goes off and, of course, wins enormous fame with his campaign in Gaul, kills a lot of people, comes back with his legions, and challenges the powers that be. Let me say that he did not come back to overthrow the Republic. They told him to disband and surrender, and this and that.
So he spends many years in Gaul, and this is about 60 to 50 B.C., and this army then becomes essentially loyal to him?
Right, but also a lot of the townships, as he comes down through the Italian peninsula, they all throw open their gates and they welcome him because they see him as a reformer, as somebody who's going to challenge this encrusted, entrenched oligarchy and aristocracy.
So a civil war breaks out, and on one side is Caesar representing the popular cause, and on the other side is Pompey.
Right.
And he allies himself with the optimates.
Yes, even though Pompey, or Pompey, however you want to pronounce his name, even though he was originally a reformer, too, during the 50s, he put in some reforms, too. See, Caesar was not totally out of Roman politics in the 50s, from 60 to 50 B.C. He came back any number of times. He had Mark Antony doing stuff for him and the like. You know, something I want to point out, Ken, which we haven't mentioned, is that the book is written on two levels. You get the history, but you also get a treatment of how that history has been repeatedly mistreated. And by that I mean most of the historians of that day and the historians of today pretty much stand with the aristocracy and the senators. And I point this out again and again, and I go back and forth and say this is what they all said about the people.
Particularly with reference to Cicero, who's given such great play in high school textbooks, you say essentially he was a mouthpiece for the aristocracy.
He was a member of the aristocracy, and he was the most active and vocal mouthpiece of the aristocracy. He catered up to them. He fawned when they appointed him as a consul. He was delighted because that meant he did become an aristocrat. You get aristocratic status if you serve as a consul. Once you do that, you, your family, and all are considered of aristocratic lineage. And he suffered terribly before that from the blue blood snobbery of the older families, you know.
So it's largely, in your book, you're redressing the balance from a history that is told really from the perspective of people like Cicero.
Totally from Cicero. And the history we get is that the Senate aristocrats loved their republic, and Caesar was a usurper and was becoming a dictator, so they had to kill him to save their republic. Well, now, how do I know that isn't the case? Well, I just point out that, in fact, later on, when Augustus comes in and forms the Principate forms, really moves toward empire and divests most of the republic institutions, they go in line completely with him. He grabbed more powers than Caesar ever did. They didn't mind at all because he wasn't doing any reform like Caesar.
Well, Caesar wins the civil war. Pompey's out, and does he go ahead I understand he's successively elected to the top position of consul year after year. Does he go through with his populist agenda?
He started to, but then he was killed. 6 months after he came back from Gaul, he was assassinated. So.
He's actually in charge, though, from about 49. You say he's a consul from 49 to 44 B.C. And you enumerate many of the proposals that he put through. Some of them had to do with land reform and unemployment and rent relief, things
right,
like
using,
that.
Right, using free labor instead of slave labor. He required that every latifundio had to have at least one-third of its labor or some proportion had to be free labor, which means they would get paid, you know, be more money in circulation. He came out against anti-luxury. He had luxury taxes. He came out with debt forgiveness, debt cancellation.
He created a modern form of personal bankruptcy to replace serfdom.
Right, so you couldn't sell yourself into slavery. You could declare bankruptcy. He also rent control. He canceled all rent payments for a year. That's not rent control. It's rent cancellation. You know how furious landlords get when they can't collect their rent. I mean, that's what it's all about.
He also redistributed great.
Had to be done in.
He distributed many of the best lands, you say, to the poor families and founded new settlements for veterans.
Yes. That when he was killed, Cicero made a very revealing comment. He said, "We've killed Caesar, but the things that made us hate him are still in place." So it wasn't that they killed him, as many historians say. Oh, they killed him because they were jealous. They killed him because he was arrogant. They opposed him because he failed to rise when a group of them came in to see him. This, that, the other thing, or, you know, he slept with half their wives, maybe, but all these guys were sleeping with each other's girlfriends and wives and whatever else. No, they killed him because he was just snipping a little bit away at their purse strings.
You said Julius Caesar committed the unpardonable sin of trying to redistribute some of the wealth of the very rich, a system of upward expropriation that they embraced as a birthright.
Right. And so they killed him. Their interest wasn't in a republic. Now look, in all the years that followed, every emperor, the Senate never once advocated returning to a republic. They never cared at all. As long as their wealth was protected, their concern was not with power for power's sake. Their concern was with wealth, not power. As long as those who had state power protected their wealth, that was it. Then they were fine with state power going into the hands of an emperor.
Well, Brutus and Cassius, the famous assassins, where did they come from? What class were they a part of?
Oh, aristocrats.
And how did they plan to kill Caesar? In the Senate, or was that sort of a last-ditch effort?
They considered a number of plots. One was to knock him off on a bridge that you walk over when you're being counted for voting. And then they realized the best place would be in this meeting he was calling of the Senate. This would arouse the least suspicion because they could all congregate right there, on a bridge. If the 10 or 15 of them were suddenly all around him, he'd know something was up. But right there in the Senate, they had to be there for the meeting, for the session. So that worked out.
He was about to take off for a military campaign, I understand.
Right, against the Parthians, in Asia Minor.
You're right, they didn't take any chances. They had gladiators in waiting in case they needed them.
Mm-hmm.
And he was stabbed 23 times. So they weren't taking any chances. And this was in 44 B.C., and he was just 55 years old. So your view is that Julius Caesar accumulated individual power, I'm quoting from your book, in order to break the oligarchic stranglehold and thereby initiate popular reforms.
Yes. At the same time, he was not immune to the glories and the acclaims and having power. Yeah, he liked that. But he does say at one point that I'm bored with that stuff. I've had my full of fame, and that let's get some changes done here, because if I don't succeed with this program, it's going to be a disaster for Rome. We will not be able to reconcile the immense contradictions that are developing in this society.
Do you think he would have voluntarily relinquished power if once his agenda had been put through?
That's a very iffy question. Once his agenda was put through, the agenda was an ongoing thing, so there would always be other problems that would come up, to sustain it and the like. But I could see him certainly handing power over to, or pushing for an election of consuls who were his guys, who shared his views, as he certainly should.
You say that the assassination was a turning point in the history of Rome, ushering in an absolute rule over Western Europe. Could you expand on that?
It was the end. I have a chapter in there called The Liberties of Power, where, as I mentioned a little earlier, it was the end of the Republic because the Senate wasn't taking any more chances, and they wanted to move more and more. So while they tell us, and while all the historians down through the ages, just about all, tell us that they killed Caesar to protect and defend their beloved republic, they themselves were moving against the republic, and they've had enough of it. Now, Augustus gave them a lot of responsibilities and a lot of visibility, but not very much power. He kept the power. It's like the faculty senate in most universities. They busy themselves, and they get reports, and they have committees and all that. But the power is in the hands of the administrators. They can do anything they want. And yet faculty members vigorously serve on their faculty senate.
So the republic was extinct, and its institutions, many of them, continued for the next 500 years of Rome's history.
Right, so you don't want to say the republic just wasn't extinguished by Augustus. We would want to say that it was siphoned out, it was drained out. That is, he accumulated autocratic power while keeping a lot of the accoutrements or structures of consuls.
You still had a Senate, you still had consuls and other officials of the old
republic.
You
still had consuls, even still had a tribunate, although that he got rid of eventually. And yes, you still had a popular assembly. Didn't do much anymore, and he hardly ever called them called them together or anything.
Do you see any parallels today between the United States?
It's always a problem. Yes, of course. It's always this is always the problem of elite interests rallying around executive power and bypassing democratic inputs, or taking the democratic institutions like Congress and buying them off with money. I mean, you have to be a multi. You have to now go to the interest, multimillionaire interest, to run for popular office. Plutocracy in this country is not going to call for the suspension of all elections. Not when they buy the election. Not when they can siphon out, before there's even a primary, who the front runners are in each party, so that they make sure that anybody with a real populist line is diminished in his status, doesn't get his or her, doesn't get exposure. They can play these institutions very well. They own the media.
Are we an empire yet?
We began this talk by saying you can be a republic and an empire. Yeah, it's still a republic, such as it is, and it certainly is an empire. An empire is not just dominion and control and global power. It also, empire means you practice imperialism, and imperialism is the when the ruling interests of one country expropriate the land, labor, resources, markets, and capital of another country.
So merely calling yourself a republic doesn't necessarily make it so.
That's right. The most mistreated actors in this history are the people themselves. The Roman people were not an idle mob just looking for bread and circuses, and that in fact they did struggle often quite valiantly for a more democratic system.
Well, thanks very much for being with us, Dr. Parenti. This is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts, and I've been talking about the life and times of Julius Caesar with Michael Parenti, author of The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. Dr. Parenti can be reached at his website, michaelparenti.org, and Parenti is spelled P-A-R-E-N-T-I. I'll be back after this short break. Welcome back to History Counts. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. Although the death of the Roman Republic took place over 2,000 years ago, the conflicts which brought it to an end continue in modern times. Take, for example, the fate of the First French Republic. Torn by class conflict and violence, the French abandoned their fledgling republic for Napoleon, a general-turned-politician who gave order but took liberty in exchange. As Dr. Parenti noted, the founding fathers of the American Republic were students of the Roman Republic. They believed that in order to protect the Republic, it's necessary to prevent concentrations of power, maintain a balance between competing economic interests, and refrain from foreign adventures. Thank you for joining us. History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and engineered by David Schwartz. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of this program and others. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.